The Saskatchewan Healthcare Coalition is hosting the All for Public Healthcare Rally in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, May 4th. It's free and you're invited. This rally is happening because our public healthcare system does not have the support it needs to meet the diverse needs of all Saskatchewan residents. For years, it has been underfunded, ignored, and hindered, so join Donna and I in person on May 4th in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan for a walk, speeches, networking, and community building. Link for more information is in the show notes. Hope to see you there. Last week, Vancouver police executed search warrants on the Drug User Liberation Front office and the homes of Dolph founders Aris Nix and Jeremy Callicum, resulting in their arrests. With us today is harm reduction advocate and Dolph co-founder Garth Mullins to help us gain a deeper understanding of what Dolph is and why this happened. Thanks for joining us, Garth.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for having me, Dan.
When I saw this happen, immediately you came to mind. So thank you for being available on such short notice. I think it was just yesterday I reached out to you. But before we dive into what happened, I think it's important to talk a little bit about what Dolph is.
Sure, yeah. The Drug User Liberation Front was formed by a couple of dozen of us, seasoned activists back in 2020. It was just as the first wave of the pandemic was cresting, and the numbers of overdose deaths were just shooting through the roof here. And we realized that government was not going to help us provide a real safe supply of drugs to people who are overdosing. And so we had to do it ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And so Dolph was born.
That's right. Yeah. We started with a few days of action, like, just in the street where we would gather together a bunch of people, people from the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users and others down on the East Hastings, and, have some speakers explain what's going on and then give the drugs to the people who needed them. Mm-hmm. And at first, when we did that, people couldn't even believe it. Like, what? People are giving away free drugs now?
Drugs are expensive.
Yeah. And so not only are they free, but we ended up for most of the last years since 2020 giving away tested heroin, coke, and meth. And that is tested with mass spectrometry so that we know there's no fentanyl or benzodiazepines or xylazine or just, brick dust or detergent or rat poison or any other garbage in there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Joining us today in studio is co-host Donna Gilchrist. Donna, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
So,
hey, Donna.
Hey, Garth. I'm glad you could be here today.
No, me too. Thanks for having me.
So in the article I read, there was no clear description as to what a compassion club is. Can you fill us in? Because it seems media doesn't particularly want people to know.
I mean, compassion clubs are a really old idea. And the way I know them from is when people who had HIV had to kind of club together and make a buyer's club to get a hold of the meds they needed, or people who were using weed for medicinal purposes kind of club together in order to pool their money, pool their resources, and buy cannabis. And those clubs managed to operate in this kind of gray area while they were both in their time technically illegal. They were able to provide the meds to the people who needed them. So Dolph was just sort of using that same old model, a club of people who needed, in this case, heroin, meth, or coke, bringing, between 40 and 50 people together to be able to access on a daily basis tested drugs so that they didn't have to go to the illegal and potentially toxic and deadly street supply.
Mm. So this is common knowledge then. These compassion clubs have been around for some time. This isn't a secret. And further to that, I guess I'm surprised there was only two arrests. When an establishment like that gets raided, surely there are more than two people present. And from what I understand, the arrests that happened didn't even happen at the office. Is that correct?
I don't know where the arrest took place. The warrants to search the office and search a couple of apartments in East Vancouver and arrest Jeremy and Aris happened all, at the same day, on the same, or around the same time. And I think it's the police are sending a message. You know, they were showing some examples. but Jeremy and Eris have also been very brave. They're very courageous, and they've been upfront about what they're doing. So they have told the world, this is what Dolph is. This is how we do it. My podcast, Crackdown, a couple of years ago, has a episode that where they both take us through the process of how Dolph works, how they obtain the drugs, how they test them. So the fact that they've been public, they've even testified in court about what they do. So the evidence is right there for the police. If the police want to know, here's a couple of individuals that have essentially been obtaining, a decent amount of drugs and then allowing for the use by other people. I guess that's why the cops chose Eris and Jeremy.
Now, I'm just going to jump in really quick because I think in terms of this Compassion Club, we should maybe touch on the fact that not just anybody can walk in off the street. From my reading of some of the materials on the Dolph website, like there has to be an established pattern of usage. So some like 16-year-old who just wants to experiment can't just walk in and get his hands on whatever he wants.
Absolutely right. Yeah. On all of Dolph's activities, the drugs go to very small number of people. Like the Compassion Club is between 40 and 50 people. Dolph has done distributions at other times to, 30 people or 40 people who are members of VANDU. But in every case, the people are known. The people are long-standing drug users with a habit that goes back, in some cases, many, many years. So yeah, if you're just new to drugs and you're 16, you're walking off the street, no, you can't obtain drugs that way.
So that, you know what, I'm just going to skip ahead here. I got a question that I'm going to expedite here. I was on LinkedIn the other day, and speaking to this exact concern, there was a post I saw published by Giuseppe Ganzi talking about regulated supply being diverted to children. Has there been any indication that this is true?
Regulated supply is also something that the government would do, right? Like a prescription, say, for Dilaudid or something like that. And I have heard Giuseppe and people like that say that. We sort of turn to the data that the Centers for Disease Control and the Coroner Service of BC have. And those data show that there isn't a big upturn in youth getting dope habits or in those kind of prescribed drugs being involved in the deaths that you see at the coroner. So in the morgue, when the coroner receives a body, they test to find out what drugs are in a tox screen, and it's always street drugs, it's always fentanyl or combinations of things. I don't know that they have any cases where the drug that's causing the overdose is from a regulated prescribed drug supply. So that's the prescription drugs, I think, that Giuseppe was talking about. Giuseppe is part of the recovery industry who, make money and run businesses to have people come in and have a stay and try and recover and all that. So, of course, that's a different thing than harm reduction. And he's been against harm reduction for a long time. So I'm not surprised to hear him say it. It is unfortunate that people make up things like that with no statistics. Can I say that a 16-year-old has never gotten a pill? Well, I got them when I was 16. I went down to Pill Corner here and was able to buy pills. You've been able to buy diverted pills in Vancouver and all over the country for decades. So, I don't think that has anything to do with harm reduction. And for the Drug User Liberation Front drugs, like the tested heroin and coke and meth here. Let me see if I can find some of the packages. Yeah. This is like a heroin. It comes in a little package. These aren't winding up with kids.
I am feeling a little bit honored that one of those actually graced the screens of Hard Knocks Talks. Finally.
Oh, for sure.
Finally.
Look, I'll get it centered there. It says the percentages. Yeah, it says the percentages.
Yeah.
And you can see And, you know, it even has on the back and the sides, it has, you know, like not for sale, it says. Mm-hmm. This is very hard for me to do. I don't know why.
It's yeah, everything's backwards, so it's...
Yeah. Anyway, you can see it gives the ingredients. It says not for sale. It has the mass spectrometry specs of what's in it, you know, and this is like in the 80-something percent diacetylmorphine, which is the fancy pharmaceutical chemical name for heroin. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it says it even has warnings on the side, you know, like opioids can be habit forming, blah, 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 blah. The same warnings that you would see anywhere. But this is packaged by people who, when they're doing it, it's illegal, you know, mm-hmm. and they got arrested for it. So this is like taking drugs out of the illegal market, testing them, labeling them, and then giving them or to people, like letting people obtain them who would otherwise be scoring from the street and would have no way of knowing what they're getting.
You know, and I've heard an argument made, and I don't know by whom, but it was by someone in Dulf saying that they are actually reducing the amount of money that's going into the illicit market by doing things the way that they're doing.
Yeah, for sure, right? If you buy in bulk, you are spending less. So mm-hmm. you're like not lining the pockets of all of the different layers. You know, when you're distributing it to people at cost, you're not making a profit. Like Dulf doesn't make a profit. Dulf gets private donations in order to get the drugs to begin with, and charges the people in the Compassion Club who, you know, who are members of Dulf. They contribute money to do this enterprise as well. So, you know, the whole thing reduces greatly the amount of money that would be going into the pockets of organized crime. I think they added it up and they have a statistic even of how much they've diverted from organized crime on their website.
I think it's around $100,000.
Mm-hmm.
So Dulf applied for an exemption from the Controlled Drug and Substance Act, or Section 56.1 exemption, correct?
Mm-hmm.
For these compassion clubs through Health Canada, and it was denied. Mm-hmm. What was the reason that Health Canada gave for this denial?
I can't remember. It was a while ago when I was aware of it. It sounded very sort of technical and bureaucratic to me. And right away, they sought to do a judicial review, which is to take the decision to court and challenge it.
But Dulf did.
Important. Yes, that's right. Okay. And it's important to know that we tried to get the exemption because we didn't want to be outlaws. We didn't want to do it illegally. We wanted to have legal standing from Health Canada, and that would allow us to go to a pharmaceutical company and purchase the drugs legally from a manufacturer, from a factory, mm-hmm. instead of having to go source it from the dark web or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's our preference, but they said no, so they kind of forced us into the situation we're in.
Mm-hmm. And like, I can't help but wonder, you know, Dulf has been around for a while, these compassion clubs, like I heard about them all the way out here in Saskatchewan. You know, they're not a secret. What happened that spurred this raid?
Well, I'd say for the last year or so, there's been a growing backlash to harm reduction, kind of a scapegoating of drug users across the country. Mm. Like the leader of the Conservative Party, Pierre Poilievre, has been screaming and yelling about safe supply and harm reduction for quite some time, even in the House of Commons. We have right-wing politicians out here who are doing the same thing. You know, there are columnists in the national newspaper chains like Post Media who are decrying safe supply, who are putting all these rumors out that safe supply is causing the overdose crisis, not actually what the coroner will tell you, which is it's not at all. So it was part of this big backlash that the police felt emboldened to go in and crack down on. So they thought there would be a public and political support for it. And there has been, you're right, there has been, or they were right, there has been political support for it. Mm-hmm. You know, the premier of BC was like, yes, this, you know, we had to do it. You have to obey the law. and that's what it's fundamentally about for a lot of the politicians. But to me, we all actually have a duty of disobeying unjust laws. That's civil disobedience. That's how we got needle exchanges. That's how mm-hmm. we got overdose prevention sites, you know, safe injection sites. Everything that's changed in drug policy over the last 30 years has come because somebody did it without permission first. You know, I was able to get methadone and that helped me. But the very first methadone clinic here in Vancouver decades ago, you know, you had right wing politicians and neighbors out picketing and protesting and not allowing it to open. So there's always been a fight about this stuff, and we've always had to break the law, and we're not the only ones. You know, before it was legal for women to vote, women were breaking the law. You know, there are all kinds of laws in Canada that have been unjust and that people have broken the law, and that's led to change. And it's not just drug users. It's every group that was wanting their rights has had to fight for them that way.
So it was Van Du that got the needle exchanges into legislation, isn't it?
Needle exchanges came before Van Du formed, but there were people like John Turvey, who was a former heroin user himself, who went around the downtown east side with a backpack full of needles that he had basically stolen from the healthcare place where he worked. And he was distributing them to people illegally. You know, so he was breaking the law first, and eventually that kind of action sort of twisted the arm of the government and embarrassed them into allowing needle exchanges. You know, Anne Livingston and people like her opened safe injection sites without permission and ran them on the downtown east side for a few years before finally the government would allow Insight to open. So it's always this way. You know, this is just the pattern, it would seem.
So were either of those people that you were talking about, were they ever actually arrested?
No, John Turvey and Anne Livingston were not arrested for what they were doing. And so we're seeing, you know, the government really and the police really digging in here and going after us in a way that they haven't usually done before. Jeremy and Eris have not yet been charged. They were arrested and... you know, the police are still investigating. The police have yet to make a recommendation to the Crown, and the Crown has to accept that recommendation. And then I guess we'll know in January whether they're going to be charged or not. And they could be charged with trafficking. So that's very scary for them. But then if they are charged with trafficking, our movements has to decide, are we going to make this a constitutional court challenge? Like, are we going to challenge this all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada on the basis that stopping us from organizing something like this Compassion Club basically abrogates people's Section 7 and 15 charter rights, you know, to freedom of the person and equality and that sort of thing? That'll be something for our movement to figure out. But I think that's one of the reasons why police in the past were sort of hesitant to arrest somebody like Anne, because they knew that she wanted the arrest so that then she could challenge the law. And once you challenge that law in the Supreme Court, you can get the law overturned, but you have to have a case to get you there first. So, I mean, this could be the silver lining that this could lead to overturning of laws or redrafting of laws like the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act, if it's found to be unconstitutional.
I was talking with my friend, Dr. Barb Fornsler, this morning, and she was saying that she doubts this will go to trial because they don't want that to happen. They don't want this to be overturned or challenged or anything like that.
Because that would be a victory for police, right? Because effectively, they've shut down Dolph now. Yeah. So Dolph is like, it's still a membership, it's still an idea, but it is not an organization that's giving tested drugs to anybody. So those 40 to 50 people who were relying on you know, this lovely, delicious, tested heroin for the past year, they are now scoring in the street and taking the risks. So it would be the police would have had their mission accomplished, shut down Dolph. But then if they don't charge them, they don't, then we don't get our day in court. And so they kind of get there, have their cake and eat it too.
So are Eris and Jeremy currently detained?
No, they were in jail for about 10 hours and were released that night. And, you know, I know you've been there, Dan, I've been there. But for people who haven't been arrested or haven't spent time inside, it is actually not a very pleasant experience. So even to spend 10 hours there can be quite scary for people. So I'm glad they didn't have to stay longer and they were given release, you know.
Were there any confiscations?
Yeah. Yeah. The police seized the drugs.
Sizable amount?
I don't know. Mm. Yeah, I don't know. Mm.
So I'm going to jump forward to this mention of the $200,000 grant to Dolph. I find that very interesting because, and you've already talked a little bit about this, that the funding for the drugs comes from membership fees and private donations and these sorts of things. But it's interesting how the media, by and large, is presenting it like it was, like Dolph was using it to purchase the drugs from the dark web.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think what you're saying is that that was absolutely not the case, and it was actually used for what it was earmarked for, that being testing.
Yeah, testing and running an overdose prevention site in the storefront down there on the downtown east side. Yeah, there was no public money, no taxpayer money was spent on buying drugs. That was all from donations and from members, kicking in. And the idea that it was otherwise has been really pushed by this, sort of conservative, right-leaning member of our legislative assembly, Eleanor Sturco, who keeps saying that we're spending government money on drugs. And that helps her, right? Because her party's in opposition. So it helps her to say, oh, the government wasn't watching their pennies. There wasn't having control over the money. And that's not the case at all. You know, the government and the health authority have very rigorous control over that money. They know exactly where it goes. Like rent in the downtown east side for a storefront is quite expensive. You know, running a mass spectrometry, that costs money. Staffing an overdose prevention site, that costs money. So, the fact that it was $200,000 a year, that's actually not very much in the grand scheme of government spending. And, you know, it was very controlled. You can't just take government money and convert it into cryptocurrency and go onto the dark web. It just doesn't work that way. And I believe that Eleanor Sturco, this MLA, would know that. But she is getting a lot of political points, I think, for just continuing to peddle this falsehood, you know.
Mm. Well, so on that top money of that, was, continue to push for prioritizing treatment and recovery as opposed to harm reduction strategies. And like you mentioned, it's very much under attack right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And that money was cut off from Dolph within hours of Eleanor Sturco, the MLA, making this point. It was about 8 hours later after she wrote a letter to the Solicitor General or whoever it was, Attorney General or something of BC, very quickly, the money was cut off. So that was it. You know, the money's cut a couple weeks later, the arrests happen, Dolph's gone, and the members who were relying on those tested drugs are now in peril.
Was there any supporting evidence along with this letter, or was this just slanderous and propaganda?
It looks slanderous and propaganda to me. I worry. It also mentioned the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users. Mm-hmm. And we have invited Eleanor Sturco to come by and to see what we do. The books are open. You can see where the money goes. She hasn't. Her office hasn't done that. So I don't believe that she's really genuine in her interests about any of this. I think she's just found something like lots of politicians have found. Scapegoating drug users, scapegoating people who are trying to help us, that always seems to get votes. Fear mongering to scare voters. It's an old game, you know?
Mm-hmm. So, in light of all of this, will Compassion Clubs continue?
Well, the Drug User Liberation Front is not operating right now. Our movements are regrouping. I think that drug users have to organize and our allies have to organize across the country because we're not the only people imperiled. This backlash is coming for everybody. And it's not just about a compassion club like Dolph. It's about prescribed safe supply. You know, like anywhere where people are prescribing Dilaudid, that's under attack. Harm reduction in general seems to be under attack. Safe injection sites are prevented from being opened or closing in British Columbia. It's across the board. So on Friday at 12:30 here on the downtown east side of Vancouver, we're going to gather at Main and Hastings and have a big rally to support DOLF, to support Safe Supply, to support harm reduction, people can go to their website, dulf.ca, and it says there how you can donate, how you can participate, how you can support the action. But it really depends. You know, it just depends on whether we're able to bring enough organization and muscle to bear. But I am worried. And I'm worried for other people across the country. I'm worried that we're going to see more arrests. I'm worried that this is just the beginning.
Hmm. Anything else?
If you want to learn more about this, we break it down in on Crackdown. We have an episode called Backlash, which you can listen to. And we're going to be covering these things as we go along. Crackdown is a podcast about the drug war made by drug users around the Vancouver Area Network.
Where can people find
it? Hosted by me. Crackdownpod.com, or just search Crackdown anywhere where you get your podcasts.
Awesome. All right, Garth, thanks so much for joining us. And
thanks, both of you. Keep up the good work and stay safe. Keep six.
All right.
Thank you. Same to you.